It's my very great pleasure to be here, particularly that I have been following your emails and your excitement over the last 2 weeks or so while I was still sitting in a country where it's now dark and windy and rainy. So I was really hoping to get here and to get some sunlight and to get to meet you. Well, there's this country that I was just talking about is actually the Netherlands. Some of you might have been there. It's a country that where 70% is below sea level. The place that is lowest is -9 meter. It's around here, Amsterdam. Yeah, it's -9 meter below sea level. Otherwise, it's fairly small. This is about 400 kilometers or so. And the city where I am is up here. It's about 2 hours by train to Amsterdam. It's a city like any other Dutch cities. It has canals, lots of water, as you might have guessed, lots of bicycles. And if I tell you that the city has 600,000 bicycles, what do you think? How many people would live in the city? Any estimates? Well, I guess you guys had been doing numbers quite a bit this week. So what do you think?
600,000.
No, 200,000. 200. So everybody has three, and I can tell you I have only one. Well, the funny thing is once the semester starts, you get to see students going to IKEA, not renting a van there, but they're renting bicycles to transport their sofas. And my last tourist office slide is this one. I just want to show you a movie. This is when bicycles have green from all four sides at the same time. And just look how organically this works, yeah? How smoothly this works. Every day I come from this side, I have to cross here. They have tried this in other Dutch cities, and they have to stop this after a day because people almost got killed. But here, it's really it works organically. Now, you might say this is yes.
So I just want to interject that there are roboticists who are working out the theory for doing the exact same thing but with self-driving vehicles.
The thing is, as a cyclist, you go straight, right? And then you look how fast is the other one? You're trying to optimize your speed. Do I have to slow down, or is the other one going? So it's the funny thing is, the only time when this goes wrong is when the new students come into the city. They're not used to it. They're too slow. They're braking, then their bicycles are piling up. So you need to go by the flow. Anyway, the flow is the key word. And now I'm transiting to the real science. Flow, metabolism, metabolic fluxes. This is going to be the theme of my lecture. So it's about this one here, beautiful biochemistry. I guess maybe some of you have bad memories about this when they had to memorize chemical reactions or so. I was wondering here, how much are you guys in need of this? Of a 5-minute talk?
Sure.
Yeah. Sure?
Sure.
Okay. So how do I do this?
Might be
too advanced.
Yeah, I mean, metabolism 1 instead of 101.
Okay. So you all know that this is 1,000 different chemical reactions, right? And the purpose of these chemical reactions is to make two things, chemical energy and building blocks for new cells. And these people have organized these 1,000 different reactions in pathways, in metabolic pathways. And if I draw the major ones, I tell the students this is the key to success. Yeah? These are is glycolysis, TCA cycle, and the pentose phosphate pathway. Yeah? So organized in pathways, so you could linearly look at this, and then you teach the students these pathways, and they memorize these reactions, but they never get to understand metabolism, because there's a number of metabolites, such as ATP, NADH, is a redox cofactor, NADPH, that make metabolism really complicated, because these are metabolites that occur at different points. And these are metabolites that always occur in pairs. Yeah? So you know the pair here, ATP, ADP, you know the pair here, NAD plus, and the other one is NADP plus. So this means they always would need to be generated. So if this is being produced in one part, then this means this one needs to be supplied somewhere else. And what that does, this ties together the functioning of metabolism tremendously. So whatever appears in one occurs in one pathway, where there is one of these energy and redox cofactors involved, has consequences on other pathways. So you could go and draw metabolism actually, in a completely different way, which is looking for this. In a completely different way, imagine you have a nutrient here, and then we have catabolism here. So catabolism is sort of breaking down stuff, making energy, and anabolism here. Then in catabolism, you know, we make ATP. We also make NADH. And then, for instance, here in anabolism, this NADH being used goes back to NADH. So that you immediately see that how things are coupled. The same coupling happens with ATP. The same coupling happens with NADH. So that means that whatever happens here has consequences here. Whatever happens here has consequences here.
And when you draw it like this, what's the meaning of having the catabolism and anabolism like meet up at a point over there?
Well, that for anabolism, where we make bigger molecules from smaller molecules, we would need ATP.
Oh no, but I mean, but you join them instead of like having like.
What's the meaning of that singular point on the left?
Yeah, the singular.
Well,
point.
This like, okay.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. Let's.
The singular point would be a substrate, a nutrient. So imagine glucose or so. Yeah? And from glucose, we break down part of the glucose, we make these metabolites here. From glucose, we make building blocks in anabolism where we also need these compounds. And this is really tightly connecting metabolism in different ways. And now the fascinating thing, what I personally find most fascinating about metabolism is the end product is always new cells, right? And you have this complicated chemical reaction network. You feed it with a nutrient, and the end product is always the same, no matter what you feed it with. So I think the beauty of metabolism is this chemical reaction network. You feed it with something, and you get the same product. Imagine you're being an organic chemist. How beautiful would it be? You start off with different substrates, and you always get the same product. But now you probably can imagine what the challenges of this 1,000 different chemical reactions, whatever you feed it with, you get the same product in a balanced way. Yeah, these things, again, need to be balanced.
Sorry, so what do you mean the same product? You mean
the same product is new cells.
Oh.
Growth, if you wish.
But new cells have many different constituents. In them, right, the components.
Yes, but say if you consider the cell a product, yeah, with all its protein, RNA, DNA or so, this is our product. This product emerges or is being synthesized from nutrients. And we can feed cells with different nutrients and we always get the same product. In a way, there people have described the metabolism here, I'm now drawing it in a small way, to have a bow tie architecture. Where on this side, it's different nutrients that can funnel into this core part of metabolism. Different nutrients, glucose, whatever, organic acids, amino acids. You can feed it with different things. They're all being funneled into this core part of metabolism. And from here, we go out to macromolecules. It could be the amino acids, nucleotides, and so on and so forth, from which are then the macromolecules made that constitute new cells. So this part here, core metabolism, core or primary energy metabolism, is where the music plays, where things come in and this magic is happening. Yes?
Could you say one more time what your little glyph that looks like a cherry with a flag sticking out of it?
This one?
Yeah, why does that... What's in that diagram?
In this diagram is a metabolic pathway that is called the glycolysis.
Yeah.
It goes from glucose in a few steps to pyruvate. Okay. This is the so-called TCA cycle, tricarboxylic acid cycle. And this is a pentose phosphate pathway. So this is sort of the major pathways. And if you compare this with the traffic in a city, yeah, then this is sort of where, in the very inner city where everything happens, and then you have people from the outskirts come in.
Okay.
So this is from a topological viewpoint, where we look at these chemical reactions from a viewpoint of topology. Now, I always already used the traffic analogy. When we look at metabolism, then nowadays we talk about metabolic fluxes. And this now goes from the static topology view to a view of activity and metabolic fluxes. Fluxes would have a unit. The unit would be usually millimole per gram dry weight. So we refer this to the mass of the cell in the hour. So it's an activity, a rate. Okay? Good. So this what I just...
Excuse me.
Yes?
Can you just give a typical number for that flux? Number, just to get an idea.
That's typically in a few millimoles in microorganisms, a few millimoles per gram dry weight and hour. This is sort of the flux in the highways of metabolism. 10 millimoles per gram dry weight an hour.
Gram
dry weight. So where, you know, you have cells, you dry them, you have a certain number of cells, you dry them, you let all water evaporate, and then you relate your fluxes to the gram dry weight. Or you could also relate it to gram proteins or whatever. It's just a. Okay, so this is what people have been tortured with. It's this traditional view of metabolism, which just tells you connectivity, how you can get from one city to another. But again, there's more happening in streets, there's traffic, so today we're interested about the dynamics of metabolism. Dynamic fluxes I added here. And the key questions that are nowadays around is why would cells use one flux distribution over another? And I should define also the term flux distribution. It's once we would have this biochemical network chart and would have all connections drawn with arrows of different sizes, then this would be a flux distribution. So that would mean we would know the traffic through this whole network. Okay? And key question is, why would cells sometimes use this flux distribution? Yeah, steer the cells through a certain part of metabolism. Why do they sometimes steer the fluxes in a different way? Yeah, what is the difference between a healthy cell and a diseased cell? And how are these fluxes regulated? So all what I was planning to tell you about has to do with fluxes. So you now see a mixed bag, but you'll see there is some logic behind it. I'll first tell you that cells have ways how they can actually measure their rate of metabolism. I'll show you that such flux measurements are integrated in regulatory feedback loops. And this has to do with the fact, what I showed you here, that the fascination of this network, we feed it with whatever nutrient you want, and the cell is able to produce new cells with it. And this, I guess, is clear, needs to be regulated. I'll show you that flux measurements are integrated in regulatory feedback loops, and I'll show you just very briefly that differences in fluxes between individual cells can lead to different populations of the same genotype. This will use about half, maybe a little less than half of the time, and then I would like to spend most time on this, which probably is also the topic that is best connected to this workshop. I think you had a question.
Yes. So in the context of the key questions you define as well as this slide,
yep.
The connection to growth comes into point number 3.
All of this is connected with growth, as you will see. Because I always look at the what are the fluxes in the whole network, and one important flux is the flux to growth, to biomass. Okay, looks like a mixed bag, but of course you guys have already spotted the common denominator here. It's all about fluxes. Okay, so let's start with point 1. What is the evidence that cells can sense their rate of metabolism? For this, we did an experiment that went as follows. We've taken yeast strains that were engineered such they had a different hexose transporter. A hexose transporter is the protein that takes up the glucose from the outside. So there was one strain that had a very bad hexose transporter, one that had a very good one. So we could cultivate these cells under exactly the same environment, lots of glucose, yeah? And we're then asking what type of metabolism were they doing. And for this, we used a technique. It's called 13C flux analysis. And details are not important, but what you guys already can see, these fluxes, these intracellular fluxes are largely different, despite the fact that the environment is completely identical. So that would argue that there is something that cells sense in themselves and then choose either to go for this or this. So here's already take home.
The guy on the right, if you had given it less glucose, would it look, I guess? Glucose?
Yes, at some point it will go here. Yeah? Because then, with extracellular glucose, you're accomplishing exactly the same. Yeah?
I'm still having to make this new transporter or something.
Yeah. Yeah, for a long time, you've probably already heard about these terms. Yeah, they're sort of two very fundamental metabolic behaviors. For a long time, it has been observed that cells only do this when there's very little glucose, only do this when they're very high glucose. But in fact, this experiment shows the only thing that matters is how fast does the glucose come in. This is what matters for a cell. So it's already that a rate is important for what they're doing. So,
and is this about like, so here you have cells which are grown in a different environment. If they're kind of grown in one environment and then rapidly switch to another, mm-hmm. is it kind of like an immediate switch or is that a switch over times?
If you would switch from a condition where they have now very little glucose, even though they would have a good transporter, then they would do this because the glucose uptake rate would be limited. And if you then give them a pulse of glucose, they would immediately switch back to this one.
When you say good and bad transporters, do you mean like affinity?
Yes. Okay, so again, I remind you here, if I say cells can measure their metabolic fluxes, then I actually tell you that they can measure a rate. And now I should see you guys stretching your head. How should cells ever be able to measure a rate? They neither have a clock, nor could they count molecules, because this is molecules converted per time, right? And in order to count, to determine a rate, you should be able to have a stopwatch and count molecules.
Wait, can you still elaborate on this? Because is it clear that it's true that they are measuring flux as opposed to just internal glucose concentration or something like that?
Yes. So the question is, of course, how could cells measure a rate? Because they, you probably agree, they cannot count and they cannot don't have a stopwatch. So the question is, how else could they infer something about a rate? And for this, I'll show you first a picture. I'll get to your point.
Sorry, I didn't understand the distinction Dan was making. The question is about the numerator is moles, not the numerator is copy number.
So I guess Dan was arguing, if I got it right, is would they maybe indirectly, by measuring something else, get to know the rate?
Or I was just saying, like, I mean, hypothetically, maybe I'm not thinking about it clearly, but they're never measuring rates at all, but all they know is their internal glucose concentration. And based on their internal glucose concentration, they decide to do one thing or another.
Yep.
And it's true that, like, you know, if you change fluxes, that'll change the internal glucose
yep.
concentration, but in that sense, you're not really measuring fluxes.
Yeah. No, I'll get to your point, because, of course, they're measuring something.
Yeah, yeah.
They need to measure something, because they don't have a stopwatch and they cannot count. Yes?
That fast switching behavior between the pathways, do you think that that's mainly kinetics, like all driven by the Michaelis-Menten sort of
yes.
dynamics, or is it because
yes.
there's some fast sort of acetylation of the enzymes? Do you have any idea what
that is? I can only guess, but I think there's indication that it's all on the enzymatic level. Sort of that there's a surplus capacity that's being used and at the step increase of the glucose influx. Fluxes. How could fluxes be measured? I'll show you first a picture. It's not the best picture, but I guess you can see it still. There's a water hose. Has a little hole in here. So if I turn this, then you probably know what's going to happen. And this is going to go up. This is a flux measurement, right? Without counting, without a stopwatch. So maybe you should get a bit more technical. There's another device that it's a flow meter that converts a flow into a height of something. very important is it's being dragged down by gravity force and pushed up by the flow resistance. So we're translating a rate, a flow rate, into something that we actually can measure. And so we were asking, could this actually be really true? And what we had some indication that there is a metabolite in this glycolytic pathway. So in here, so glucose comes in here, and then one metabolite here, that this would be a metabolite if the enzyme kinetics and the regulation are such that, that flux information is imprinted in this, to, in this metabolite, yeah, then we could call this a flux signaling metabolite. You can immediately see that cell, that this does not come for free. There needs to be particularly regulation to accomplish this, yeah, to, so that the level of this metabolite strictly would correlate or follow the flux through this pathway. If this metabolite then interacts with any other protein or whatever, a transcription factor, then all this together could be conceptually a flux sensor, like all this together is also a flux sensor. And then the metabolite that we found is fructose bisphosphate. It's again a metabolite in the middle of glycolysis, and in E. coli it inhibits a transcription factor. We then did a respective experiment where we experimentally controlled the flux through this pathway, measured the activity of this transcription factor. We saw it going down because this is an inhibition, and this level of metabolite went up. So this looked very promising, and we would call this metabolite again a flux signaling metabolite. And a flux signaling metabolite has the property that its concentration would correlate with the flux through this pathway. So if you now envision a diagram where we have the level of this metabolite on the x-axis and the flux on the y-axis, then this should look very familiar to you because that's nothing else than the two axes with which every enzyme kinetic is described, right? Here the substrate concentration and here the reaction rate, and then what immediately comes to your mind would be Michaelis-Menten kinetic. Now you're seeing here, oh, look, Matthias, there is a linear part, and you're just selling us this as something very special. Yeah, here it's in this part, this metabolite would follow the flux in a linear way. The surprise came to us, and you also know that this would just happen in the part of the Km value, right? Now it turned out when we looked at this metabolite, that this stretched had a linear part that went way beyond the Km value. I'll show this to you here. So now these two axes are mirrored on the diagonal. Yeah, so now the metabolite, the substrate is here, the flux is here. The Km value is here, but it's linear way beyond the Km value. So we needed something else. And this relates to what I told you earlier here. There needs to be specific enzyme kinetics and regulation to accomplish such linearity over a very broad range. And here the question that I'm basically asking, what is now the transfer function that receives flux as an input? It has the level of this flux signaling metabolite as an output. What is in this box? What is doing this?
Again, not to belabor what I was asking before, I guess I'm just like conceptually not understanding. Like what is the evidence that like flux is ever being measured, or that's the right way of thinking about it? Or yeah, like maybe if you could just say a little argument.
No, I think it's a very good question. So flux is an emerging property, right?
Yes.
And what I'm also suggesting here, there's an emerging property that picks up flux, converts it into something else that is then doing something.
But I guess I just what's confusing me is what is the evidence that that's what's happening? That it's really flux, that's the thing that's ever being detected.
Yeah. So the evidence that this metabolite correlates with flux is there. It's a correlation,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes.
And that I would argue is this level correlates with flux. I would say is also an emerging property.
Okay, yes.
Yeah. So I'm just now asked. Oh, what I should say is that this metabolite really regulates tons of things. And I think one could use that as an argument that this regulates tons of things as a function of flux. Do I make sense?
I think so.
I hope so.
Actually, I have a question about the next slide.
Yes.
To do with the black box.
Yes. So now I'm asking, what is now establishing actually this linear correlation? What mechanism is responsible that we get this linearity way beyond the Km value?
But here, are you asking how FBP is sensing glucose flux in, and then how that regulates glycolytic flux out? I feel like we have a couple different fluxes.
Yes. No, the out regulation I haven't touched yet. At this moment, I just want to know, how do I get this correlation? What does the cell do in order to get this linear correlation?
Can you rule out any feedback from FBP back to the flux?
Partly. There is some feedback, but I hope that if I go into this, I will confuse you even more. So let us first.
Yes. I have a comment. So let's assume that flux is being sensed.
Yes.
And things are responding. I'm just coming at it from a chemical reaction perspective. There's no need, it appears, that I need to invoke an anthropocentric perspective on sensing. Because if I were to have a chemical reaction network, the flux would determine how the whole reaction system responds. I don't need to add any extra. I mean, there may be a reason you're doing it, because we haven't come to the other parts of your presentation, but my argument is flux determining the reaction is a very chemical reactor centric.
But now you said flux determining the reaction.
Yes. Rate limiting steps.
I'm not covering this yet. I'm just telling you something. The cell is doing something, and I'll show you what the cell does. In order to translate flux into information would be in here, in order to do something else.
Okay.
Well, so I think his comment was that, you know, if you would just look at combustion, if you vary oxygen levels, you get a different intermediate distribution. You still get the same product at the end, but the chemical network is different just by relative concentrations. No information involved. It's just initial concentrations.
That's exactly right. So I was saying, if you replace the word cell with a reactor or a combustion system, it may do almost the things you're saying.
Maybe it chooses
a different pathway, both based on free energy. And
I'm not yet choosing any different pathway. I'm using the same pathway, but I'm using the same pathway with different rates.
Okay.
It's an open system, steady state. I'm using the system with different rates. And I was and this is what the experiment that I started with. It's the same pathway, at least for glycolysis. So the entry where glucose comes in, but yet downstream they do different things. Okay. And that argued that they need to measure how fast things go. The essential thing in the talk next to flux is rates, as you will see. Yes?
For that experiment, what's the reference?
I think we haven't published this yet. But I can send you the data if you want.
For that, the data you showed where you plot FBP as a function of flux.
Yes.
So to get that plot, how are you doing perturbations?
Yes.
So what kind of perturbations are you doing? By changing glucose or?
It was glucose-limited chemostat cultures, where we then measured the physiological parameters and did 13C flux analysis to really quantify this axis. And we did metabolomics to quantify this axis.
So what is the condition that you're controlling for to get different data points?
It's the rate with which we feed the cells in here. That determines growth rate.
Dilution rate is what you're...
It's the dilution rate. And then we later measure or infer what is the glucose uptake rate. Yeah? Okay, let me get to the black box.
Okay, this is kind of related to Dan's question and Yuhai's question. So here you have the arrows going to the right, and you're like causal.
Yes.
So what's the evidence they're not going left instead? You know what I mean? You have this, like, you're saying that the flux causes the FBP concentration, but why isn't it not that the FBP concentration causes the flux?
Because we, in this experiment, we perturb flux. There's no way that you can perturb the metabolite level. What we perturb is sort of, here in this experiment, we perturb flux, and here, we perturb flux.
Oh, but the whatever FBP can affect the flux. It doesn't have to affect the flux. It's something you can control, which then can control itself. That's the feedback.
Yeah, and that's why I answered partly to your question with the FBP. That FBP has downstream regulatory targets, but not. It doesn't seem that it has upstream in glycolysis anything to do. So it does.
Upstream, just going to the box, going to the box that goes from the flux to the.
So you're arguing that it would go to this box. Yeah. And I'm arguing what this box is,
right.
Their FBP doesn't have a say over it.
No.
It only has a say over downstream processes. Now, it cannot exclude that the downstream processes, other metabolic pathways, have a feedback on this box.
Yeah,
that I cannot exclude, and that's why I said partly.
Yeah.
Okay. But it seems, look at this entry point here, this metabolic pathway, really something that's the main highway. It's just stuff flowing in with a rate that is controlled by the outside, by the environment, or by the number of transport. It just flows in. And apparently this pathway is so important that the cell needs and wants to know how much glucose am I currently processing at this moment. And I hope it will make sense to you once we get to the second part. Where I tell you why it's so important for cells to know how fast they're doing. Okay, I'll cut this short because this was published.
Linear means no feedback, right? Normal. If you have feedback, typically it's not.
Yeah. And they would go along the line. It's just, this is really input, and it converts this into an output. So what is now in this box? This is the half of the glycolytic pathway, the lower one, fructose bisphosphate. This metabolite is here. And then there's only reversible reactions here until pyruvate kinase. And what now establishes this linearity is a feed-forward activation of this last enzyme. So the way you have to perceive this now, the first consuming enzyme that would have its Km value, as FBP builds up, this later part sort of is pulling more, and therefore it stretches this linear part over an extremely long, over extremely broad range. Do you get an intuition? Okay, so this you can read up.
A little confusing here. For example, if I take the Km literally for the enzyme, I don't know, FBA is the enzyme,
yep.
Right? So I think literally you are saying the Km for FBA is really low, right, technically. Right. So if that guy is saturated,
and it doesn't saturate because this one is pulling, as sort of we would run into the saturation, they're pulling back here.
So it's never saturated.
And because all these reactions are reversible, it never saturates. This is the black box. Yes.
Do you need an irreversible process, or could you have the same thing with staggered Michaelis-Menten constants and an appropriate rate constant? So say you have input FBP is kind of slow and has a relatively high Km, and then things downstream have, or a relatively moderate Km, and then things downstream have higher Km's, higher rates that can pull. They're still in equilibrium, but that could significantly, expand your linear regime by just pure enzyme matching rather than irreversible process.
I would say I'm jet lagged too much in order to clearly answer your question, but
a fair answer.
So maybe related to the question. Sorry. So right now, just to understand your point, you're saying that look.
if you look at the straw man of a single microspintron reaction, then everything depends on Km, and that doesn't work out here.
Yeah.
But I guess sort of a related question to what was asked before was, what if you had a series of microspintron reactions? Could that effectively be your black box? In other words, if you had two or three, could they sort of couple together? And
well, there are a number. It's actually, I think, three or four reactions that are already here. I cannot answer your question because it's so much related and it's so much related to my problem at the moment. let me get to, I really would like to get you to the cool stuff at the end also. Okay, this was done in E. coli, and it turns out that in other organisms that we looked at, either also budding yeast, we found this metabolite to correlate. And you probably also know that in cancer, the most important phenotype in cancer is high rates of glycolysis. And I guess it doesn't surprise you that also this metabolite is high in cancer cells. So I would even argue that this is a flux signaling metabolite across organisms. Because it's a flux signaling metabolite, we have recently engineered a molecular sensor for this that works in yeast. So if this is, for those of you who works experimental, do experimental work, so we now can, on the single cell level, sort of via measuring FVP levels, infer what is the flux in an individual cell. Okay, now, if such flux sensing mechanisms exist, we have found is that they actually are integrated in global feedback loops. And this looks a bit complicated, I'll walk you through it. Now imagine that something changes, some nutrient changes here, and a different nutrient is flowing into this core part of this network. What then happens is that almost passively metabolic fluxes will change, right? Some fluxes will go down because the previous nutrient is not there anymore. Some other stuff will flow into this network. Fluxes change more or less passively. These passively changed fluxes are then at certain flux sensors via the concentration of flux signaling metabolites are sensed. Transcription factors, activities change, promoter activities are changed, enzyme concentration are changed, and then we close a feedback loop. I guess I don't have to tell you that feedback loops are actually great to maneuver a system from one state to the other. And we think that this is sort of the mechanism where the key thing is measuring fluxes at different points in this core part of the network. It's actually great in order to adjust the gene and protein expression such that this network here, this core part of metabolism, actually is able to convert a different nutrient again in the same product, namely new cells. And what is cool, actually, if you just, E. coli can grow on 150 different carbon sources, and it would be a nightmare to sense all these different carbon sources and to even integrate this information. Yeah? Imagine what kind of computation this would need to be for this poor E. coli cell. But if you just measure at a few points here the fluxes and integrate the information, here at this part of the network flux is high, at this part of the network flux is low. If you just integrate this information, makes the task much easier than sensing different carbon sources. So here's take home message number two. Flux measurements are integrated, and also this can be read up if you'd like.
So I should think of the growth rate at a given growth condition as a function of mainly metabolic fluxes.
Yes. So the growth rate that you get is a result of the fluxes that you have.
But what are the other laws?
Other knobs would be how active is your ribosome or so, yeah. But also even that could be flux dependent.
So you would say if you were growing a bug at the same growth rate, say in a chemostat, but using a different carbon source, FVP would be the same concentration?
No, because FVP is a sensor for the glycolytic flux.
Okay.
There's other such flux signaling metabolites that signal flux in other pathways. Imagine a traffic control system somewhere that has a computer that changes traffic signs during the day depending on the traffic. So you would have a few measurement points where you measure traffic, and it goes all into the computer and then changes the traffic signs and actually directs car traffic. And I think the same happens here. And again, if I get to the second part, I will tell you why it makes so much sense for cells to mesh, to know what their fluxes are.
So before you go there, so for the two, so I'm just confused by that. You showed us before the glucose flux. Where is that? Is that the uptake part? And the second is, where's FBP? Is that the...
Well, FBP is one of these flux signaling metabolites.
Okay, what about
FBP? And FBP, together with its downstream transcription factor and the transcription factor, what it does, closes feedback loops. We have at least three more other flux signaling metabolites, for all of which we found sort of this global architecture. So that means that for certain metabolic pathways, and the regulation of it, it's certain flux signaling metabolites, for others, it's others. So this is sort of a generic picture that shows you that flux signaling is integrated in feedback loops, but it's sort of generic, and I could plot this for you for FBP, I could plot this also for you for FBP.
And the glucose is actually outside of this loop?
Yes, so this glucose or carbon source is outside, yeah? Okay. So that's the input into. Good point. Feedback circuit, you all know that there's also noise, molecular noise happening in cells. So if you have feedback architectures, such as the one that I just showed you, fluctuations in intracellular molecules, I guess I'm not telling you anything new, but from this, different phenotypes could emerge. And now I cut this part short, otherwise, in essence, what we have found that indeed, on the basis of flux measurement, on the basis of differences in metabolic flux between individual cells, we could actually get multiple stable phenotypes. Once we perturb cells in such a manner that we very quickly change nutrients. Very quickly change nutrients. All cells are slightly different, just from a stochastic point of view. And we could show that on the basis of such feedback circuits, including flux measurements, we could get different stable phenotypes emerging. If you're interested,
tell us what variables determine phenotypes: size, shape,
growth. In this case, so we could find here when we very rapidly switched cells from glucose to a completely different carbon source, that certain cells could get this feedback going on the basis of their momentary molecular phenotype. Others not, which would not grow. Yes?
I think there should be like some feedback loop from growth signaling to this.
I guess so too, yeah. Yeah. Okay, so if you, also for this, there's a paper down here where you could, this is already a bit older work. I'll just leave it with a key message that flux differences on the individual cell level can even lead to different phenotypes.
Sorry, by phenotypes you mean just like different ways of metabolizing?
No, the phenotypic differences here were extreme, such that you had a growing population and a non-growing population.
Okay. Is it possible to measure like really subtle phenotypes? Like, oh, you know, I really digest this sugar really badly and I'm intolerant to this one sugar, whereas these other ones...
I think that the tricky part here, the good thing here, because we had so dramatic differences, growth, it was relatively easy to measure different speeds of growth. If you need to measure different metabolic fluxes on an individual cell level, this is more tricky.
Okay. And just related to like the question which I had before, so like in this with the causality, like you think flux difference, like. Well, I'm not sure what you're saying. So, are you saying, I guess is the question, that the flux differences are causing the differences in growth rates, or the different phenotypes are maybe causing the differences in fluxes?
There is different...
There are guys who have different phenotypes and different fluxes.
Yes.
But you're not making a statement about what's causing what?
No.
No, okay.
So, in condition one, prior to the perturbation, there's... there's, for stochastic reasons, differences between the cells, but it's still a unimodal population. And these differences might be due to stochastic noise in gene and protein expression, which also might propagate into different fluxes. And now it, once this nutrient shift happens, then certain cells of this population get this sort of feedback going, other ones not.
Is that because those, is FBP acting with like a critical threshold? If
yes.
It goes above some level,
yes.
Then
yes.
Gray gets
yes, exactly.
So I'm wondering how important is this genetic regulation, like this is the CRA. So what will happen if you delete knockdown CRA? Can the cells still survive?
Yeah, we have done in a huge amount of, a large number of perturbations, exactly like the ones that you've mentioned, deleted it, modulated the abundance of this. And then with this, we could actually tune the behavior. And we also played around with playing with the FVP levels, but this is all in this paper. Okay, I'll conclude on the first part. So it's a mid-recap. So I'll show you that cells distribute metabolic fluxes in a flux-dependent manner. So cells measure metabolic flux, apparently via flux signaling metabolites. And here is, again, the traffic analogy. Traffic jams, traffic is being measured, fed into a control system, and then regulation, yeah, traffic signs changing over day would change. Okay? But the question is now, why would there need to be flux-dependent regulation? Yeah, what is the logic? Why would cells actually need to reshuffle fluxes in a flux-dependent manner? And what is the logic of this traffic control system?
Can I ask you?
Yes.
So this control, it goes through sensing and then transcription and so on. So it's, what's the time scale of this control?
Sort of the downstream control, you mean?
Okay,
yeah. It's partly, well, what I've shown you here was via transcription translation. But other downstream action is also directly on the enzymatic level.
You're talking about hours?
No, transcription translation in bacteria that would be something 15 minutes. On the enzymatic level, allosteric level, it would probably be a matter of seconds to have for the downstream action to take place.
I have a question. Generally, in cell biology, people believe like signaling sensor, like mTOR, senses the metabolic, like a starvation metabolic flux. What is enter in the control system that you presented? Where is that? I mean,
bacteria don't have mTOR. So that's my. As far as I know, the real input, what really activates TOR, I think is still largely elusive, if I'm not mistaken. And, you know, there's so many people working on TOR, and now I'm only speculating, right? There's so many people working on mTOR, haven't really found the input into the signaling pathway. And maybe it's something that is as much of a emerging property as a metabolite level here, so which might mean that for this reason it's very difficult to find it. But that's maybe too much speculation even.
So you just mentioned the allosteric regulation. So do you, in these feedback loops where you have this kind of longer time that's happening through transcription, is there any evidence that these same flux signaling metabolites have faster action through allosteric interactions or like protein modification like phosphorylation or acetylation?
So really FVP is not only acting via transcription, but it also acts directly on the enzymatic level. So it seems that and also, being a metabolite, yeah, it responds extremely rapidly to changes in flux. Yeah? And then you probably go in the first line of defense. You know, you allosteric regulate, and then later also would follow up with transcription translation. And I cannot exclude that acetylation and other things are involved in this as well.
But did you do that experiment? And you could imagine change the flux, glucose cuts suddenly to a different level.
Yeah.
And how does it catch up with the linear curve?
We didn't do it quantitatively, but if you change flux very rapidly, there's this metabolite response immediately.
Immediately. So the response time
is
very, very fast.
Super fast, yeah. Okay. So I hope that I showed you guys or convinced you that, yeah, flux matters, and apparently cells have found ways to sense flux. I'll give you one example that flux sensing is integrated in feedback loops, yeah, good for adaptation. But still, why have cells chosen to, if you allow me to use these words, yeah, to use flux sensing and flux dependent regulation? And now I'll move into the second part. Before I move into this, so I'll come back to this paradigm example of why use cells sometimes this type of metabolism, why do they sometimes use this one? And here, these figures that I draw are, again, this one here, where I just omitted this pathway. So this should be the glycolytic pathway that breaks down glucose. This is the TCA cycle. And you probably know that when cells funnel all this material into TCA cycle, at some point, they will all respire it, produce CO2. Yeah? It's combustion. Alternatively, they could do something that is called aerobic fermentation, where even under presence of oxygen, they would do this type of metabolism. So don't funnel these molecules into the TCA cycle, but sort of dump these molecules half used. Yeah, I guess you have heard about this before. And of course, and this is now budding yeast, the question is, why would they ever do this? Well, of course, there's a good reason, otherwise we would not have beer. But from the perspective of the yeast cell, it's actually very bad to do this. And there's three reasons why they should not do this. First, because they get less ATP per glucose. Yeah, the textbook knowledge tells you if you do this type of metabolism, you get something like 30 ATP per glucose. Here, if you do this, you get 2. Yeah? Why would you ever do this? Second, here you get much less biomass out of it per mole of glucose. Why? Yeah, because you dump 2 carbon molecules that are not fully oxidized yet. Third, ethanol, even though yeast cells produce ethanol can even be toxic, even for yeast cells. So three reasons not to do this, but yet they do it. And I here remind you of when they do this. Do you still remember? I told you, right? They do this once the glucose uptake rate is high. Then they do aerobic fermentation. Once the glucose uptake rate is low, they respire. That's an efficient metabolism. This is sort of a wasteful metabolism. If you're doing something stupid, it's good if you're not the only one. And there's many other organisms that do exactly the same. E. coli doesn't produce ethanol, but produces acetate, but it's the same flux distribution, literally. Mammalian cells do exactly the same, and I could extend this list much longer. So, and what is interesting, if you talk to the yeast community, they come with their niche explanation. The E. coli community comes with another explanation, and the strangest explanation here is that the mammalian community, as you might have guessed, they say, lactate, this, wait a sec, what do I know about lactate? This is being recorded, maybe show my show. This is an acid, maybe the tumor acidifies the environment and paves its way, yeah, for growth. That's sort of the weirdest thing that I've heard. Anyway, when we started with this, looking across organisms, and me being a very simple person, I thought, there needs to be a simple explanation. And before I go into our hypothesis, I should add a disclaimer here. This question has been looked at by many other colleagues in the last couple of years. The predominant theory at the moment is the one on protein allocation. You might have heard about this. That means there have been a number of papers that sort of suggest that cells have a certain amount of enzymes that they can use. And the question is, for which pathways would they invest the amount of enzymes that they have? And the point being that this type of metabolism needs much more enzymes than this one. Yeah, because here the pathway is much shorter than here. So this is what some of my colleagues proposed. This is the disclaimer and just tells you I'm aware of this. At the same time, when they have started with this, we had asked again what could be the reason for this. And
I have a question.
Yes.
Would that also mean that the rate is faster to produce ATP for that process?
Here, if you do this, you get 2 ATP. And I told you that you do this once your glucose uptake rate is high. So now you could calculate at this super glucose uptake rate, how many ATPs do you produce per time? And you could compare this to this type of metabolism, where overall you get more ATP, but you only do this metabolism when you're slow. And I haven't done the math, because I think it's also very confusing to think along these lines, and we'll see in a minute.
A little bit confusing, because the first part, where it generates 2 ATP,
yeah,
is shear, isn't it?
Sorry?
It's shear. It's the same between the two, respiration and
yes.
fermentation.
Yes.
So it cannot be faster.
Yeah. No, I fully agree. That's also why I, you know.
Oh, but you're not doing as much with the cell. You're not making that whole. So you cut off.
That's fine, but at least I'm making.
You make the same two here and here. Yeah.
Exactly.
I would ask you, forget about all of this what you've heard until now. No, not from me, but from whatever you knew. And I'll walk you through what we think is happening, and then we can open up the broader discussion again.
Regarding that question, I think because fermentation can be faster than TCA, so even though the first part is shared, it can still be faster if the rate limiting part is TCA.
Because it just doesn't get trapped in that.
Yeah. For example, if TCA, that circular part is the rate limiting part, you can bypass that by going to the right.
But you don't have to go to the circle, you just stop there.
No, the reason why this type of thinking is so confusing is because you still make cells. And for cells, you have a certain amount of ATP that you need, right? So your ATP yield that you need to make cells, you still need the same amount of ATP to make cells. So your ATP has to come from somewhere. So this is the point that you now threw in is exactly what has been around in literature, and I think it hasn't helped. And I hope that by the end you will see why, or hopefully understand what's going on. Yes?
Super basic question. In the comparison between fast versus slow glucose uptake, what is setting the scale of what is fast and what is slow?
So the fast would be for budding yeast. Again, this is a microorganism. It's in generally high metabolic rates. Just to give you a feel, it would be 10 millimoles of glucose per gram dry weight an hour, and the slow would be 2 millimoles of glucose per gram dry weight an hour, so a factor of 5.
And I should compare these numbers with what?
With, for instance, doubling times of 100 minutes versus 300 minutes or so. Okay. Again, we were asking why are they doing this? And I already told you when they are doing this. Namely, they do fermentation if glucose uptake rate is high, and respiration when it's low. And from here, we said there's different organisms that do the same thing. I told you that there's protein allocation is one explanation. And we asked, is there rather something that is more physical that underlies this? And here I get now to the cellular energetics. So the hypothesis that we raised a few years ago is, could it be that the rate at which cells can dissipate Gibbs energy, that this could be limited? And in a way, I'll pull up this high school scheme here. We have a reaction from A to B, between C and D, happens with a certain rate. You know that there's plot this Gibbs energy reaction coordinate. AB would have high formation energy. This would have low formation energy. We would have the delta RG in between. So if you now go and multiply this by this, then I get the Gibbs energy dissipation rate of this particular reaction. Now there's not only this reaction happening in a cell, but there's 1,000 different reactions. So what I'm going to do is I sum this up over all metabolic reactions, and then I get the cellular Gibbs energy dissipation rate. And what the hypothesis says is that this value here might have an upper limit. Are you all with me?
Could you give some intuition why that might be the case?
A bit of the intuition was, if you have a machine, and this machine would be designed for a certain speed or whatever, and if you would run this machine below this speed, then it would overheat or break. That would sort of be the intuition that we had here. Super important that you understand this equation here for the rest.
So a super naive question. So if I take the cell as a black box,
yes.
So I put in glucose,
yep.
And the rest comes out CO2. So can I just naively get the global delta G,
yes.
Instead of worrying about the details?
And you could write down a full reaction equation that goes from glucose plus oxygen giving biomass plus CO2 plus whatever. This is your whole reaction equation.
Yeah.
If you know how fast this reaction goes, then you have this. And you have the overall delta G from your substrate to your end product, and you have this.
Yeah.
This is exactly the same to what happens, what the sum overall metabolic reactions would do. Right? Very good point. I will come to that, in the next slide. So again, our hypothesis was that this value here would have an upper limit. Or a lower limit because it's a minus term. Yeah.
It all depends on what kind of environmental constraints you have to, just that upper limit.
Well, at this moment, this is just a hypothesis that there is an upper limit, that cells would be governed by an upper limit in this value.
So again, I have a question. If you take any inorganic matter, right, and if you continue to pump energy into it, it will also melt or explode or something. So it also has a lower limit of free energy.
No, look, what I'm saying here, this is not a, this is a rate of free energy release.
Right.
This one here.
Because if it is not dissipated, then there's an accumulation and the system can break down, even inorganic systems.
But we're looking here at cells as an open system, meaning that whatever we dissipate would also need to be dissipated to the environment. Mm-hmm. What is very important here to understand that this is a rate of dissipation. And I'm asking or hypothesizing that the rate of dissipation, that there could be an upper limit.
I mean, we have talked a lot about it before you came, about the fluxes. This is really the fluxes. The way,
exactly.
Without blowing up, is to circulate them, so that you can create a steady state with a positive number of this dissipation rate. Because you're not, that's what maybe related to the question. If you keep injecting, right? So if it's going through the overall pool of energy, so the energy just keep going up, and eventually blow up. But this is a flux. This is not not an increase of overall free energy.
Exactly, but whatever is dissipated in the cell needs to go outside, otherwise the cell could not be at a steady state, right? So. It has to be at a steady state in terms of mass balances, and also has to be in steady state in terms of Gibbs energy that is being exchanged.
This is the part of energy that has to drive those cycles, which does not increase the overall total energy of the system, but it's dissipated. After
yes.
it's done its function, it's just done its job.
Yep.
So to tie it with Jin's question, if the cell were cooled, you may have a different free energy limit. Do you agree?
Yep.
So the external constraints or the conditions, that was what he was trying to. Is that right, Jim?
Yeah.
Yep. Well, I'll also get to this.
But also in the equilibrium state, there is no principle of saying the dissipation is maximized or minimized.
No, I haven't said this. Have you heard me saying I'm minimizing or maximizing dissipation? This is also what has been around. I'm just saying, I'm proposing at this moment, I haven't shown you yet, I'm proposing that this value just might have an upper limit.
So you're imagining that this is, for instance, set by the viscosity of the medium around, which dissipates the...
Well, let me just put this down as a hypothesis, and I haven't shown you yet whether this hypothesis is actually true, and then we think about what it actually would mean. Okay?
It should be said, though, that a priori there's no reason to expect that the rate should be related to the total amount of free energy available, right? The rate is something that depends on time, whereas the free energy is just an energy, it's a static quantity, and so... in principle, what you're saying is that every reaction that dissipates energy has some barrier that is going to, act as a kinetic limitation to how quickly you can release that free energy?
I think you guys think way too complex. I just do a bit of how bookkeeping. I know these 1,000 different metabolic reactions. I know their substrate concentration. I know their product concentration at steady state, at a steady state growth, right? So for each reaction, I can calculate the delta G, and I know each flux, and then I multiply these two things, and I know for this reaction how much joule this reaction dissipates at the very moment. And I know this for all other metabolic reactions, and sum it up, and this gives me a number, and I propose that this number is limited. Okay.
So how does this deal with the mass?
It comes. It will come. Okay. So in order to find out whether this hypothesis is true, of course we needed to determine those. And the way to determine this, we use the model-based analysis of experimental data. So you had suggested a way of how we could determine it for different conditions, measuring the overall kinetics of the overall equation, reaction equation. We did it a bit differently, which yielded more accurate values. And the way we did it is we wrote down a stoichiometric model. That's stoichiometry of all of 350 metabolic reactions of budding yeast, where the reaction took place in either cytoplasm or mitochondria. Because there's transport, metabolite transport across membranes is highly uncertain. We included different variants, stoichiometric variants. We considered all reactions to be reversible. There were also two other equations that describe proton and charge balance. So there's just linear equations that describe what the stoichiometry, the connectivity in the metabolic network. Then for the thermodynamics, for each reaction we defined the second law, meaning that delta G has a concentration-dependent manner, metabolite concentration-dependent manner, times the flux needs to be smaller than zero, and it gives energy balance, meaning that whatever is dissipated in metabolic reactions, so that's this part, the delta RG of a reaction times the flux, needs to be equal to whatever is exchanged with the environment. So imagine now a glucose molecule coming into the system. Glucose molecule has a certain formation energy, and I know with what kind of rate it comes into the system. And it's being processed, and the carbon dioxide is sort of leaves the system again with a certain formation energy and a certain rate. So this equation just enforces that whatever mass is being exchanged between the cell and its environment, it also it gives energy is sort of exchanged in the same way. Are you with me? So these are the equations.
That VEXG, that part is much simpler than the...
This one is just the overall sort of how much glucose. So this part describes just the overall reaction, right? The one that you proposed earlier. And you immediately can see is that this would be the way of how you would have determined this value. Yeah, but we can also determine this value with this. Or we can give both equations to this model and make this model-based analysis of experimental data much more robust.
So do you need to know reaction rates and concentrations of all metabolites?
Yes, not all. But just to give you a sense for how these equations look like, there's the stoichiometric matrix, and there's some of the other equations that I just showed you here. So this is for the model side, experimental data side. We had growth rate, metabolite uptake and excretion rates, metabolite measurements. So this was the for different conditions. And then standard Gibbs energies from a method that is called the component contribution method that sort of dissects metabolites, molecules into groups, and then determines the energy contribution for different groups. So we can also calculate with this standard Gibbs energies for almost all metabolites. But this comes with a price, namely that it's not available for all reactions. There are some certain uncertainties, not all the same thermodynamic reference states. So we could not readily use this. So this is why we actually pushed this through a regression analysis, where we took this model, this data, formulated an optimization problem where we used the known standard Gibbs energies as priors in a with a regularization problem. It's just meant to give you a sense for the exercise. And the time of this exercise of building this model and getting these optimizations to work was about 2.5 years. Where the key problem was the optimization, where you immediately saw they're not nice, they're nonlinear, mixed integer, pain in some body part. Anyway, we got here. And cost me many sleepless nights because the PhD student had to graduate, and this was his first figure. So what this figure shows is growth rate here, different conditions, and this is the cellular Gibbs energy dissipation rate. Yeah, so there's G this that I showed introduced you earlier. So once the growth rate is low, Gibbs energy dissipation rate is low. Once we increase the growth rate, it goes up and up and up. And if you look at this one here, it seems that they're not further going up, although the growth rate is further increasing. Do you agree? And it turns out that these are also the conditions where ethanol is being produced. So that made us conjecture that maybe here, maybe this could be the ceiling. Maybe this is the upper limit that we had conjectured earlier. So that we would say cells could not operate at a Gibbs energy dissipation rate that goes beyond the -3.7. Yes?
So these are with E. coli?
This is budding yeast. I'll show you E. coli data in a second.
So as your knowledge keeps increasing, as your bound going down?
Sorry, D?
Okay, so you said you've optimized the model versus data.
Yep.
And the model versus knowledge.
Yep.
Both the data and knowledge are increasing over time. Does your bound moving over time?
No, what we had to do for this optimization, maybe I lost you here, is I needed for all the reactions in the model, I needed a standard Gibbs energy of reaction. And this optimization that I showed you on the next slide was just to determine these values for each and every reaction in the model.
Okay, so what if you miss some of the reactions? Or I'm saying as your knowledge, is your knowledge as far as reaction is concerned not complete, or?
No, I told you earlier that a usual metabolic network has 1,000 reactions. Here we use 350, just because that's what we computationally could handle.
I'm just saying the constraint you put on, based on prior knowledge,
yep,
it doesn't change anymore. So that's how you can set the limit. Because I'm just saying, if your constraint, become more constrained than you currently know, how would that change?
How robust is your bound?
How would it change?
If
you take some of the known constraint away, your bound, is it going up?
Well, we did the same exercise for E. coli with a much less constrained model, and it turned out that the value is almost the same as for budding yeast. But I'll first, this is has just been a computational exercise. I just have inferred the cellular Gibbs energy dissipation rates from a number of measurements. And I just plot them here and just see, well, for me this smells like an upper bound, like a constraint, yeah? But is this constraint now actually doing something? And I will show you in the next slide.
But have you just tried to do the kind of naive way, the black box way? Because if you can measure all the growth rates and everything, can you just, without doing that 350 reaction method?
The point is that then you need super highly accurate measurements. And physiological measurements are usually dirty.
Of what? Like the highly accurate of?
Of the fluxes into the cell and out of the cell. And you need to measure everything super accurately. Otherwise, errors in these measurements propagate through this and distort this enormously.
So how do you think the cell does it?
Sorry?
So how do you think the cell does it?
The cell is, when we look at the black box that he suggested, then we just measure what goes in and what measures out. But the inputs and output is connected through the stoichiometry of the metabolic network. Yeah? And that's what we make use of here in this optimization, where we... So all the measurements that we have together in this optimization, and then that's why these estimates are relatively robust. even given the uncertainty of the measurements.
How does it compare with many, many years ago, this flux balance analysis is pretty popular?
This part here, up until here, is nothing else than flux balance analysis.
Okay, yeah, that's something.
Well, it's stoichiometric modeling until here, yeah? But what I now do is, I showed you this value, and at least at this point we thought, oh, this is the limit that we were looking for, but is this limit now actually determining metabolism? And now I do real flux balance analysis with it.
One basic question, the x-axis is only being changed by nutrient volume.
Yeah, or speed of nutrient uptake.
Speed, okay.
You remind me of the measurements that you have done actually, again, to get this point, so.
There were also chemostat cultures, yeast grown at different dilution rates.
Yes.
These are these different points.
So what you know is dilution rates and the...
And the glucose uptake rate, the growth rate, the ethanol production rates, that's what you know. And that's what has been fed into this optimization.
So does the... This might be a very naive question. Does the median change the bound in any way, or is it completely irrelevant for...
It has to.
Okay.
But just... It has to, and it does that by the concentrations of the outside metabolites, right? Have increased the glucose concentration and deplete my substrate concentration, then the delta between those will get bigger. But it's just small, the effect. Okay. No? Yes?
Yeah, so just because you mentioned you like to be simple, it seems like the way that this, that a physicist would do this measurement would be just to measure the heat that's being released. It's not turning into chemical energy, right? Because all the delta G in there that's not going into product released heat or
yep.
the excess energy. So is that just a technical, it seems like?
Well, others have done this in the past. They've done bacterial physiology in a calorimeter, yeah?
So if you did a growth rate dependence where you're varying glucose levels or varying their ability to uptake, and you were just measuring the heat being released by this process,
yep.
You would, in principle, see the same effect. You'd see a break in that heat.
I'm not sure, because here I'm plotting, heat is part of this, right? And only one part of this. Yeah, so the delta H, meaning delta S, delta H
yeah.
minus TDS.
But if you know cell density, that's something to measure of your... Delta S contribution, right?
I don't know. There's also other metabolites. Yeah, how do you CO2 and ethanol or so? Okay. Let's assume there is this limit. Yeah, we just infer this value from data. It's nothing else than an inference, and we sort of conjectured that this could be a limit. But is this now really responsible for what metabolism is doing? And now we do what you mentioned, namely flux balance analysis. We take this model, which does not have a unique solution, but we now specify the identified Gibbs energy dissipation limit. Yeah, that's the -3.7 from the previous slide. We wanted to do new predictions, compare these new predictions with new experimental data, and if on the basis of this, we can make good predictions that this would argue, yeah, this value has something to it.
But the flux balance analysis, as the original forum, try to optimize the only growth rate.
Yes.
You also do that, or you're on top of that?
I'll come to this. So flux balance analysis, you know, okay, there's a model that we now added this limit to it, gives you solution space. And now the question is, how do you evaluate this space? In this field, people use then mathematical optimization. They define a particular objective, and with this they identify this point, which is then the point of where these fluxes should be. This evolutionary criterion, what people mostly use it for microorganisms would be that they try to find the point where the growth rate would be maximal. Because this is yeast, we did exactly the same. So on the next slide, I show you now predictions of this model. This will be a black line, and comparison with experimental data will be red dots. And everything plotted as a function of the glucose uptake rate. ethanol production rate, oxygen uptake rate corresponds with respiration, and the growth rate. So what you see, once the glucose uptake rate is low, cells don't produce any ethanol. Here at this point, this is where the Gibbs energy, the cellular Gibbs energy dissipation rate is being reached. Now cells start to produce ethanol. They reduce respiration, and cells still can grow faster, but not as efficient anymore. So what they basically do is they take away flux from respiration to provide the cell with this Gibbs-free energy dissipation space, if you wish, with which the additional glucose molecules can be converted. And that was now badly explained, I think. The first thing that you see is that these predictions, again, the black line and the experimental data compare very well. And this was achieved with a growth rate objective. So that fitted pretty well. And if you tried other objective function, that I guess is your question.
No, just another thing. So if you plot on the same plot, the actual, what do you call it, the energy dissipation rate would be flat?
It comes in two further slides. So other objective functions, as you can see, these are the other colored lines, were unable to reproduce this data. So I really suggest that growth rate maximization under this Gibbs energy dissipation limit will be the one that gives the best predictions. And not just, these are predictions of physiological parameters, so rates that go into the cell and leave the cell. If you zoomed into the intracellular metabolic reactions, I'll show you four fluxes through four reactions. Again, the black line is prediction, and the red dots are measurements. And you see that this corresponds pretty well, and this is not just handpicked, that fitted with other fluxes as well. So here, conclusion would be, the objective of growth maximization under this Gibbs energy dissipation rate limit, apparently we get good predictions. And now I come to your question. So now plot here glucose uptake rate, Gibbs energy dissipation rate, now determined for different parts of metabolism. So this blue one is respiration and TCA cycle. You can see once the glucose uptake rate is pretty low, about 45% of the Gibbs energy is all dissipated in TCA cycle and respiration. Once we go to high glucose uptake rate, right, and we get dissipate here in two reactions of glycolysis, about 40%. And you could see, but of course this is the in the model, this does not go further up because that's a minus 3.7.
But before you reach that point, the total doesn't go to the top.
Because we're maximizing growth rate here.
Right.
I don't maximize Gibbs energy dissipation rate, right? For me, this is in this approach, this is just a constraint.
Right.
And this is the big difference to whatever had been done before.
Right. So before you reached that point, that constraint was not really
active. Was not active, exactly. Yeah.
Wait, so like speaking of like growing cells in different media, so can you grow them, like for example, with like, so they don't have to make certain amino acids, they can just eat them, and then presumably.
Comes.
Okay.
So if I now plot here the biomass yield would be how much biomass we make per gram of glucose. You would see here low glucose uptake rate, we make it at a very efficient. Why are we making it efficient? Yeah, because cells, you can use respiration. And as we move along here, they have to take a flux away from respiration and dump the glucose molecules half used as ethanol, just to being able to accommodate the additional glucose molecules that we put into cells. Because the processing of them also causes dissipation. That means that the biomass yield, the amount of biomass that we get out, will be lower and lower and lower.
I missed it. When you were looking at other things to optimize, like, if you put in some type of like constraint on growth rate, so there's a maximum, you know, there's only so fast your ribosomes can go, or something like that. That also doesn't work. I didn't see if you like, yeah.
Sorry, this light.
Okay.
One thing that was remarkable, these are the data that you showed that you've seen before, but I'm not sure whether you paid attention to this point here. What happens in the simulation here goes up, reaches a maximum, and even though that in the optimization, you're optimizing for growth, growth rate goes down again.
That's the prediction.
Prediction, exactly. And yeah, I guess your guy's asking now, why is this happening? So we're basically, I'm force feeding cells here. I'm putting more glucose per time in them, right? And that means they have to process these glucose molecules, which causes dissipation. So, but I don't allow them to dissipate anymore, so they have to reduce something else. And what they reduce is growth rate. That's their only way at what they can do at this point here. They reduce growth rate and start to produce glycerol. That's exactly what yeast cells do.
So
if this is glucose comes in here, ethanol goes from here, glycerol exits the cells here. So we force feed glucose molecules in here, and they try to get rid of them as fast as possible, process them only a few steps, because these few steps will cost dissipation, right? And then they dump it as early as possible. But that goes at the cost of reducing the growth rate. So if I do an completely unconstrained FBA, just with the Gibbs energy dissipation rate, maximal Gibbs energy dissipation rate constrained, I can even predict the correct maximal growth rate. And as a matter of fact, we did not find any experimental data to the right of this point. There's no experimental data here. Why? Because a yeast cell would be so stupid to take up more glucose molecules than this one. Because if this is all right, they would have to reduce their growth rate.
So you put in experiment a very high, they just don't have a transporter or whatever, they just refuse to take.
We're currently doing this experiment, so where we sort of modulate the transporter, yeah, so that they would take up more and more, sort of deregulate the transporter. Usually transporter is regulated. Yeah. and indeed seems to be such to go down again. What is missing is the control experiment where we also overexpress the naive protein that we haven't done yet. Yeah, sorry. Because it could also be a protein burden that is affecting here. Yes?
So your data, did you have a point there in that last point for the oxygen, or why is that not?
Well, we pulled here data from different sources. And there's no oxygen measurement. As you can see, this is also from a different paper or so. There are apparently no oxygen measurements.
I'm just curious because, you know, there's a counter hypothesis that you could make that's not physical in nature but chemical in nature, that's your processing oxygen has a misfire rate, and that correlates to oxidative stress and cellular damage. And so if you are a cell and you see a small amount of glucose, you're going to say, well, I can deal with the risk there. I need to process this, and I need to do it efficiently because I need to survive. As you continue to increase glucose, though, some might say, this is way too much. Our machinery is going to run rampant, and we're going to have oxidative damage.
Yep.
We need to keep a certain amount of ATP levels correlated to oxygen levels to maintain healthy genetic replication.
Yep. Okay, so I would argue with data that I'll show you in the next slide, I would argue against your hypothesis. Specifically, we've done now the same exercise for E. coli, this time with a much bigger model. Yeah, coming back to your earlier, would it be just that the model is too constrained? Now it's basically not constrained anymore. We get to an almost similar value. Earlier was minus 3.7, now it's minus 4.9. I'll get back to this value in a second. And also here, we had similar good predictions, but what you now did is, we took this model and predicted also different nutrient conditions where metabolism was completely different, where oxygen and so on was not involved.
Excuse me, what was the difference from the 3.7?
This is another organism. The other earlier was budding yeast, now it's E. coli. So we now took this model and made other predictions compared with the experimental data, and here it's a comparison between experimental measurements predicted, and I would say this is also a fairly good correlation. And the most interesting thing actually was this one here. We have taken this in silico E. coli model, and we have now given this E. coli cell all amino acids and glucose that it could choose from. And we said, well, E. coli cell, take whatever you want, excrete whatever you want, grow as fast as possible, but don't exceed the Gibbs energy dissipation rate. Don't exceed this value. And what this model had predicted is a doubling time of 22 minutes. And I guess you all know how fast E. coli can maximally grow, right? It's 20 minutes. And this is when I really personally started to believe this, because this model had not seen anything like complex medium in its making. This is a mere prediction. So also this is sort of excluding that here oxygen, reactive oxygen species would have a role, because most, it's still aerobic, but here in this case they're not relying so much on respiration anyway.
Can you do the flux balance model but without the dissipation constraint?
No. When we do it without, then it would be completely unconstrained, and then you know growth rate would be 10,000, whatever you set as a constraint in your model.
You still need a protomotive force, though. I mean, I guess I'm not, you're saying that there's minimal oxygen processing in this environment, so if you just took away oxygen, they would grow at the same rate.
And the condition here with this complex medium, you mean?
Yeah, I mean, so you're saying that you're getting this number, and they have all the different pathways to sample, and that suggests that it's not the oxygen problem. It's
or maybe together with the fact that we had different nutrients, where there's also gluconeogenic substrates, and that across nutrients the predictions were fairly good. I would argue would exclude a specific role of reactive oxygen species as being toxic or so.
So how robust was this? So in this model you sort of constrained and you said you don't exceed a dissipation rate of -4.9 to 3.0. How so? Let's say you do the same calculations but with a different constraint. How robust is this number? 22. So in other words, if you do this calculation for like -6, -10, does the thing change?
It will change, yeah.
Or is it saying substantial, or is it just enough to have an upper bound? Or does the actual value of the upper bound matter?
No, the value also matters.
Okay.
Yeah. For this, we haven't done sensitivity studies, but for others, we have. Okay. It matters.
So it's not just enough to have a constraint, but the physical number.
Yeah.
One question. So I remember work. I was wondering, I think the value for the growth rate for when E. coli, the fermentation starts to happen, like the overflow metabolism, is around 0.7, right? So
depends between E. coli cells, it's different. E. coli strains.
Yeah, I guess my question is this regime where this dissipation constraint on the power that you dissipate becomes a constraint, does it coincide with the
Yes. I think I jump over this.
Another question is like, so this upper bound, does that depend on what kind of nutrient you feed into the cell? For example, you actually feed glycerol, feed pyruvate, feed glucose differently, like different nutrients. Like, is there no way to get past this threshold experimentally?
That we haven't checked, but I would argue, because we take this very one value that we determined from glucose condition,
yes,
and take this value and make predictions on completely other conditions, and I get right predictions, I would say that this value must be also hold be the same for these other conditions. Or did I lose you?
Yeah, I think that's one evidence, but it can be supplemented with actually experimentally,
sure
if you can ever
go
past that or not.
We haven't done it. So I'll conclude this part, and then there's a few slides left for thinking.
What was the message for?
Sorry?
I'm waiting for the message.
Oh, here it is. So apparently, cells try to grow as fast as possible, at least microbial cells, but they would not do so at the expense of exceeding this dissipation rate. I guess talking to a physics audience here, I guess this probably reminds you about this gentleman.
This is the third time or fourth time.
I'm very sorry, but I'll add something to this slide, to this statement. If it's right, what we have been doing is that there might be an upper limit which cells can do so. And that cells might actually, that this actually might govern metabolism. I think somebody had asked it, what is now this upper limit? Does it differ between organisms or so? Yeah, I think it was you. So how universal would it be? Well, the two values that we have now determined was E. coli and budding yeast. Now there are different values, yes. But given the fact that these organisms are largely different in volume, they live in different environments, I would argue this is probably around the same value, right?
This per unit mass.
It's per unit mass, exactly.
What's the C, the unit?
Gram cell dry weight. So in order to compare these numbers, we've also used heat production rates from this paper that had determined for organisms of largely different sizes. And we took this data and plotted it together with ours in such a way that we here have either the heat production rate or the Gibbs energy dissipation rate. So the black symbols are ours. These open symbols are from here. And here we have picogram carbon per cell. So everything that is on a diagonal here would have constant picowatt per gram carbon. And I would say, if you look at our two values, they have exactly the same slope as this one. Of course, there's an offset, because this paper just measures heat production, versus we have delta G production rate. That's why there needs to be an offset, because the remainder is the entropic part.
It almost begs the question, if the total dissipation is the limit, or the some kind of total enzyme is the limit.
Yes. So let me first conclude here that apparently it seems that there is, at least for mesophilic organism, there might be a constant, so biomass-specific constant picowatts. That would be the limiting factor. But the question is, and the one that you raised now, others have proposed that there is a limit in protein allocation. I'm proposing there's a limit in Gibbs energy dissipation rate. Mathematically, it almost boils down to the same thing. In both cases, it's a weighted sum of flux that is being constrained. In my case, the weight is a delta G that is concentration dependent. Protein allocation constraints, it's a constraint on kcat divided by enzyme mass or so that is being. So mathematically, it's very similar. That's why it's also not surprising that similar results are obtained. The question is now, what is the truth? And this, the truth would probably lie here if you are able to find out, is there anything mechanistic, actually? And here I would need your help. Because what I will show you is hand waving from a physics-naive person.
One question is, are you saying Gibbs energy dissipation or dissipation rate?
Rate.
That's, yeah.
Oh, yes. All what I said is rate. Today I've talked about nothing else than rates, right? Fluxes are rates, Gibbs energy dissipation rates, all rates.
And these results from the Falkowski paper, these are all from bugs growing at maximum rate, I remember.
That I also don't remember. But I would assume so. So what Gibbs energy dissipation rate, let's assume that my first naive thought might be that this had to do with temperature. Right? If we let all this Gibbs energy dissipated, convert it all into heat, let this heat all emerge at the very center of such a budding yeast cell and calculate the temperature profile over the radius of the cell. And a big disappointment, 0.00005 Kelvin delta. Yeah, okay, it's not heat. What else is it then? And here, again, hypothesis, and I would like you to scrutinize it as much as you can. What if part of the, I screwed up my animations. Don't look at this. What if Gibbs energy that is released during catalysis, if part of this would be used to give this enzyme a little push? So that this enzyme essentially would be a motor. If all enzymes are doing this, and all enzymes are going around like motors, how would the cytoplasm look like? Not just like this, which is the depiction of Brownian motion, but we now would have an active component here. We have more movement, which looks like Brownian motion, because it's chaotic. But it would have an active component here.
It's a higher temperature effect.
Yeah, and this is where I'm still crushing my head against the wall. And if this is true, yeah, then if you think about certain biomolecular functions, if there's too much movement, they would probably not work anymore. Think about you being a protein that just got folded right, just had the right three-dimensional structure, and the colleagues are bumping into you constantly. Or you're being a transcription factor, you try to bind to a promoter, takes you a while until you firmly grab onto, but there's so much movement that you cannot grab onto your promoter. Then, taking this together, it could mean that if this is all true, dissipation rate being converted into increased macromolecular motion, then this could be that at some point, life or the functioning of life would not be possible anymore.
So just a quick comment. There are some groups who have measured the, extra diffusion or whatever you will.
This one here? Yeah.
Steve Granick and a bunch of others. Have you looked at those numbers and seen if...
Although this is hand-waving, there is, and I guess you guys are fully aware of the evidence for different parts. I'll walk you through it. Yeah? Highly debated, is there this increased diffusion, in vitro measurements, substrates added, increased diffusion have been observed. I think the fuss is here that still nobody has really a clear theory of how this would work. But I think the accumulating evidence on the experimental side is increasing.
You mean present or when landing and flying off?
Sorry?
Do you mean when the enzyme finds its substrate, grabs onto it, and then you say that it can diffuse faster with the substrate?
I think that's what's not clear. In this case, it would need to be such that the reaction would lead to this being pushed.
So when it binds and then it gets a kick, and then when it unbinds and then
yes.
It gets another kick.
Yep.
I think there's a fair amount of evidence it's still obviously, but that there's anisotropic energy dissipation in these enzymes, that heat release during the reaction is anisotropic. And so that's what is manifesting in superdiffusion.
This is very controversial.
Yeah.
But it is still,
I think even a lot of the phenomena of people is controversial, but certainly in the explanation,
yeah.
I think what you're proposing.
Well, I mean, and demonstrated anisotropic.
I think that's very controversial. I wouldn't use the word demonstrated. There are many groups who have written papers on it.
Yeah.
Where they say we demonstrate.
let's go one step higher. There have also been papers that, and this is one from Christine Jakobs-Wagner, showing if there's no metabolic activity, that cytoplasm is glass-like. If this happens, then these sort of active movement component of enzymes could actually break this glass-like property. There's... are you still thinking, or are you jumping in my face immediately? there's also work from Chris Voigt, at some point, was a Nature Biotech paper, had, from a theoretical point of view, concluded that initiation of translation could only work at a temperature above 1,000 Kelvin. So, of course, it is not. But if you have increased movement, that could actually be the thing that is doing it. If you go further, there have been temperature measurements, molecular sensors that had been put into mitochondria, concluded as 10 degrees more, There have been fights about this as well, because it cannot be a gradient. But if it's active movement of macromolecules, that could actually be exactly the thing that quenches this fluorescence in mitochondria, which would sort of mimic a 10 degree higher temperature in mitochondria. Lastly, also this paper had concluded that apparently the diffusion that is present in the cytoplasm would also correspond to higher temperatures. So overall, with the evidence that I showed, plus different pieces here and there, I think there might be something to it. And if that is the case, then we actually would get another regulatory loop here that would regulate metabolism. Cool, huh? But where metabolism is good of getting molecules in motion, this would lead to the fact that some transcription factors would not work anymore. Yeah, that could feed back on metabolism, and we could have a rate, Gibbs energy dissipation rate dependent regulation of metabolism. And all of this, if this is a simple summary, we have beer because of molecule movements, if this is true. Okay, I think I'll leave it at this. I'd be super happy to hear your thoughts on this. Yeah, thank you very much.
So just sort of back envelope calculation, which have been carried out here. Given, suppose you know the amount of enzyme that's in action, right? And you also know that the loop, each loop, I mean, the currency of dissipation is ATP hydrolysis. Let's assume that's the main. So each loop, and for each, you know, hydrolysis, you know what ATP is being consumed, and delta G is roughly at 20 kT. And now also given the concentration of enzyme and their catalytic rate, and can you estimate the rate, the dissipation rate, and compared to the values that you want, the maximum, and see if I'm trying to say is, can you translate this constraint from energy to concentration of enzyme? And you can do that because you have an energy unit, which is 20 kBT ATP, and you also know it. Suppose you know the typical rate of enzymatic rate, then you translate what you have to a concentration.
Well, what we can do is, because this model not only gives us also prediction on intracellular fluxes. So for each and every enzymatic step,
right, yes.
I can give you the rate. For each and every step, I can give you the metabolite data.
Right.
Proteomics for each and every step gives us the enzyme concentration. So very easy to do these calculations. And I know for each and every step, I can give you the delta G, right?
So if I say the total enzyme is the limit, and I do the same optimization plot, would I get the same result?
Again, this could simply be due to fact that structurally, in terms of math, in terms of equations, it's exactly the same.
That would be perfect. Yeah. I mean, I think there you may have a different set of mechanistic reason why that can be, you know, because you have certain capacity of making this enzyme, right, so. Because the other route of dissipation limit is, unless you have some limit of dissipating heat.
No, dissipating heat, or?
I mean, this, by the way, is true in real computer, because that's the way.
Yeah.
Some of the rate-limiting step is actually you have to cool the system, otherwise you just.
I think it's not a problem of transfer. And because of this. Because if it would be a transfer problem, this value would scale with size. But it does not scale with size. It's specific to the gram carbon. So I think it's a size independent thing. And
no, I'm not saying it's size. I'm saying it is enzyme, which is carbon, right?
Okay, so you're looking at the level of an individual enzyme.
Some over all the relevant enzyme that is involved in this metabolic.
So then I'm not sure whether I get your point.
The point is that can you use a constraint, instead of using the
total dissipation.
Rate?
Rate. And you use, the rate can come in just simply by saying that you know the rate, typical catalytic rate, right? Your, K-cat, let's say.
Yeah.
Right, so give a wrap, right? And then your constraint then will be, your constraint is, can be translated into, not translated, can be taken as equivalent to a constraint of total enzyme concentration. And if I do that, use that as a limit, do fast balance analysis, would I get a similar kind of result?
Well, again, this is just because it can be pure math, that in our case, I had this value, which was constrained
right.
with this, yeah? And what others do with protein constraint, they say a value of x is the sum of fluxes, the same here, and this is k cat times mass of the enzyme, yeah? People have done this and get to a similar good predictions. But I say it's not surprising because it's in terms of math, it's the same.
So you say that overall they get in terms of the overall growth and so on. But these two will have different partition. So that's what something you say. For each individual reaction,
yeah,
this would predict probably different answers. So if you take a particular reaction,
mm-hmm.
the flux in that part of the reaction will be different depending on which limit you use. These are not equivalent. These two, globally, they are similar.
Yeah, and then the question is, yeah, we're here. So the uncertainty here is here, right? Because that does not account for any regulation. It just takes the maximal k-cat, yeah?
Right.
So I'm not sure how much tuning is actually needed if you do this approach.
So it's k-cat over mi, it has kinetic information more than just delta g.
Yep, exactly.
Right.
Yep.
Okay.
I was wondering how you can keep like the processes like autophagy, because they are not directly dependent on the metabolic flux, but they
yeah.
are the processes that can provide cells with ATP and raw materials. Like, does it have any effect on the Gibbs energy dissipation rate, or have you looked at that or?
No, it's a good point. Of course, there's other things happening in cells besides metabolism, but think about signaling. I guess Jonathan has talked about autophagy, any kind of turnover that would use ATP, ATP hydrolysis. So how is this accounted for here, right? I told you we start off when we do this, that we measure how much glucose goes in, how much oxygen goes in, how much carbon dioxide and the byproducts go out. This defines the overall what is being dissipated overall, right? So it's and this is then being shared between metabolism and between signaling and autophagy and blah 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 blah. Yeah, the fact that in our approach we had ourselves made blind for signaling, we have blind for turnover, and yet get a good match between the overall balance and what happens inside, only considering metabolism, I would conclude that probably signaling and all other ATP usage has probably a minor contribution. Do you follow? Does it make sense? But it's a good question. We have one term in the model that is sort of a generic ATP hydrolysis process, which sort of where we sort of lump these things in, where these are things being lumped into.
But in that sense, it doesn't necessarily mean that stuff isn't important. It just means it's just kind of like you said, lumped
in, and it's probably in terms of the rest of the metabolic ATP turnover, it's marginal.
So have you thought about how this relates to multicellular patterns in this fermentation oxidative metabolism switch? So in lots of developing insects and embryo, we've heard about vertebrate embryos, they'll do this lactate metabolism when I think there's a lot of cell proliferation.
Yeah. fast growth. Yeah, it's exactly the same here. Whenever they grow fast, yeah, there's fast growth. When they do this, yeah.
But actually following up on that, at least in mouse, they do this switch from, you know, where they start doing more glycolysis. Actually, they do both more glycolysis and more oxidative phosphorylation, but they turn on glycolysis even before they do any growth at all.
Even before they?
Even before that they have any growth.
Mm-hmm.
And so they start doing more glycolysis. So it's not just tied to growth, but maybe...
Yeah. No, of course, yeah.
But maybe I guess in your framework you would say, well, maybe they start doing other things,
yep.
and then there's this limit on dissipation, and I guess in your framework you would say that's not because of growth, but because they start doing more signaling or who knows what, right? I see.
Yep. And in fact, if you continue with this, yeah, it would go down. Growth at some point would stop, but if they're still processing glucose molecules, they need to do something with it. They need to dump it also.
They're putting in energy stores when you're multicellular, right? I mean, as they go through development, that's at least, well, I'm an insect biologist, so, you know, essentially later in development, that's going to the cell growth, but not division, and putting on energy stores. So maybe that's just things are getting diverted.
Energy storage is actually a very smart thing to do. Because usually, you come from glucose, yeah, and to go to glycerol or to glycogen, that's just a few steps from glucose. You put it away, put it aside, but you're not processing it. Meaning, if you're not processing it, you're not dissipating. I'll show you one last slide, because this is only part of the things that we do in our lab. So, when I talked about this, it all gears towards how does metabolism actually work. I actually have a second research line that is asking how does metabolism control other processes. And the most recent work we have actually done to show that metabolism, this network of 1,000 different reactions, is actually an oscillator, an autonomous cell cycle, CDK-independent oscillator, which we think is actually even driving the cells through the cell cycle. So if you,
it's a slave.
Sorry,
it's not just a slave. It's a.
I think it's the master. If you want, I'll be happy to also sort of talk about this, because I think what I'm now trying to do is actually connect these two things. Where a temporal segregation of metabolism could actually have reasons that emerge from here, because if you temporally segregate different metabolic processes, you could actually be faster because you're avoiding thermodynamic compromises that you need to do. But that's maybe for later.
All right.